Welcome back, everyone, to the Deep Dive. You guys sent in a really an interesting case this time.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, it's got it all. Family drama, property disputes, and an otter sanctuary. I mean, really.
Sounds like a legal thriller waiting to happen.
Right. So we're diving into Young v. Young, a 2008 Washington State Supreme Court decision that really digs into the whole concept of unjust enrichment.
Yeah, Young v. Young. I actually remember that one. It's fascinating, really, because it deals with such a specialized property, right? I mean, otter sanctuaries aren't exactly something you come across every day.
No, not at all.
And that's where these interesting legal questions pop up that you don't see in more, I guess you could say, standard cases.
Definitely. So let's set the scene a little bit. We have Judith Young, who owns and runs this otter sanctuary down in Georgia. And she decides, you know what? I'm going to relocate the whole operation up to Washington State.
Wow.
Which, just thinking about it, the logistics alone, that's a whole other story.
Absolutely.
And this is where her nephew, Jim Young, and his wife, Shannon, step in. They help her find a suitable property.
And, you know, right off the bat, we see a potential issue here. Jim's name gets added to the title of the property that Judith buys.
Oh, really?
Yeah. And that, even though it seems like a small detail, that actually speaks volumes about, I think, the expectations and maybe some potential compensation issues down the line.
Interesting. So it suggests that there was some understanding that, you know, Jim wouldn't be doing all this just out of the goodness of his heart.
Exactly. Yeah. There was an expectation there, at least on Jim's part.
Got it. So tell me about the property. What was it like?
So the property they find is, well, it's kind of a fixer-upper. It's in Thurston County. It's got potential, but it definitely needs work. Judith buys it for $1,050,000.
Wow. That's quite an investment.
Yeah, it is. And get this, Jim and Shannon, they actually move on to the property to oversee the renovations.
So they're not just contractors, they're living there.
Yeah, living on site. They're putting in a ton of sweat equity, really transforming this place to make it a functional otter sanctuary.
Wow, that's dedication. That shows you how committed they were to making this happen.
Absolutely. It wasn't just a 9-to-5 job for them. This was their life. And it's important to highlight that level of involvement because it really speaks to the amount of time, energy, and probably even some of their own resources they poured into this project.
Yeah, it really emphasizes that it wasn't just about the money for them. It was about helping family and realizing Judith's vision.
Totally. But, you know, family matters can be tricky. Sometimes those relationships, they go sour. And that's exactly what happened here. Things between Judith and Jim, they fall apart.
What happened?
And all those unspoken agreements, all those expectations about compensation for all the work Jim and Shannon put in, well, they kind of just vanish into thin air. And it begs the question, what legal recourse do you have when a family agreement breaks down like that, especially when you've got significant property improvements at stake?
That's a really good question. I mean, it's one thing if you're just talking about, I don't know, helping your aunt paint her living room on the weekends. But when you've got a property worth over $1 million and you've poured countless hours into renovating it.
Exactly. The stakes are much higher.
So what happens next? Does this end up in some kind of legal showdown?
It does. Judith takes the matter to court, seeking to quiet title. Essentially, she's trying to get Jim's name removed from the property ownership documents. She wants him off the title.
So she's basically saying, this is my property, get out.
Yeah, pretty much. But Jim and Shannon, they're not backing down. They fight back with a countersuit, claiming unjust enrichment.
Ooh. So this is where it gets interesting, right? This is where the whole concept of unjust enrichment really takes center stage.
Exactly. Now, to win an unjust enrichment claim, there are three key elements you've got to establish. And the first one is that the defendant, in this case Judith, received a benefit.
And I'm guessing a fully functional otter sanctuary on her property would count as a pretty significant benefit, right?
You bet. The second element is that this benefit has to be at the plaintiff's expense. In other words, did Jim and Shannon suffer some kind of loss to create this benefit for Judith?
Well, they definitely put in tons of work, and like you said earlier, probably even some of their own money.
Yeah.
That sounds like a pretty clear yes to me. What do you think?
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, they invested a lot, no question. And then there's the third element. It's got to be unjust for the defendant to hold on to that benefit without paying for it. Now, this one can get kind of tricky, right? It's not always so black and white.
So it's not just about the letter of the law. It's about fairness.
Exactly. You got to consider the whole picture, all the circumstances, and see if one party's, you know, essentially profiting unfairly from someone else's hard work.
And I'm guessing that's where the initial trial court may be They didn't quite grasp the nuances of the situation?
You could say that, yeah. They did deduct some of Jim and Shannon's costs from the amount they were awarded, but they didn't really get, I think, the full extent of the benefit that Judith received.
So it's kind of like they focused on the cost of the flour and eggs, but missed the fact that Jim and Shannon had baked a delicious cake, so to speak.
I like that. Yeah, that's a great analogy. And that's where the Washington Supreme Court stepped in. They basically said, hold on a minute, lower court. You can't just look at what the plaintiffs spent. You need to consider the market value of the benefit that the defendant got. And then, bam, they reversed the lower court's decision.
So instead of zeroing in on what Jim and Shannon put into the project, they shifted the focus to how much Judith's property actually increased in value because of their work.
Exactly. And that shift also puts the burden of proof on the defendant. If they're saying, hey, I shouldn't have to pay the full market value for those improvements, well, they got to prove why.
Interesting. So in this case, Judith would have to demonstrate that Jim and Shannon were somehow at fault for those improvements, or that the improvements they made didn't actually increase the value of the property all that much.
Exactly. You got it. And that's a really, really important point for lawyers to understand, especially when you're dealing with these kind of property improvement cases, you know, especially within families.
Right. So what are some key takeaways here for our listeners, especially for those who might find themselves in a similar situation?
Okay. Well, first and foremost, document everything. Don't just rely on like good intentions or, you know, oh, we talked about it over dinner. Get it in writing.
Especially when it comes to family and property, right?
Yeah, exactly. Because memories fade, relationships change, and suddenly that casual conversation can turn into a full-blown legal battle.
Nobody wants that.
Nobody. And secondly, when you're figuring out the value of those improvements, focus on the market value, the actual benefit received. Not just like a list of expenses. Think big picture. It's about the overall increase in the property's worth.
That makes a lot of sense. And what about that third element, that it has to be unjust for the defendant to keep the benefit without paying? How does that play out in a practical sense?
That's where you got to think about pleading unjust enrichment as an alternative to breach of contract.
So even if there's no formal contract, this legal theory can kind of act as a safety net.
Exactly. It helps to ensure fairness, to prevent one party from basically walking away with a freebie.
So even without a written agreement, the law recognizes that there are situations where someone deserves to be compensated for their work and the benefit they provided.
Exactly. Now, Young v. Young brings to light a lot of important legal considerations, but it also leaves us with some questions. Like, for example, how do you figure out the market value of a property that has such a unique purpose, like an otter sanctuary?
Right. It's not like you can just go on Zillow and compare it to the house next door.
Nope. And that's where things get really interesting. It's a head scratcher, right? Trying to find comparable properties to figure out the value when you're talking about something as specialized as an otter sanctuary.
Yeah, it definitely throws a wrench into the traditional methods.
This case really forces you to think outside the box. You can't just plug numbers into a formula. It's about looking at the bigger picture, the heart of the issue. Was someone unjustly enriched? Did they get a benefit they didn't really deserve to keep without paying for it?
It seems like the court was really wrestling with the idea of fairness, just as much as they were looking at legal precedents.
Absolutely. And that's what I love about equity. You know, it tries to reach a just outcome, even when the strict letter of the law doesn't quite capture all the nuances of a situation.
I see what you mean. It's about more than just ticking boxes and following a rigid set of rules.
Exactly. And this case also shines a light on something that often confuses people, and that's the difference between a contract that's implied, in fact, and a contract that's implied in law.
You mean like quasi-contracts?
Yeah, quasi-contracts, exactly.
Okay, so contracts implied, in fact, quasi-contracts, those sound like two sides of the same coin. What's the difference?
All right, so a contract implied, in fact, that's based on how the parties acted. Like an unspoken agreement where both sides understand that payment's expected for services, right? Think of it like going to a restaurant. You order food, you eat it, and you're expected to pay, even if you never signed anything.
Makes sense.
Yeah.
So the agreement is implied by what you do, by your actions. So where does this whole quasi-contract thing come in? It kind of sounds like a legal loophole or something.
Not quite a loophole, but it is different. A quasi-contract, see, that's not a real contract based on any sort of agreement. It's more like a legal fiction, you know? A tool that courts use to stop someone from being treated unfairly when one party gets a benefit at the expense of someone else.
So it's about making things right when someone gets a free ride they shouldn't have.
Precisely. Even if a formal contract doesn't exist, you can still use this idea of a quasi-contract to make sure things are fair.
So in Young v. Young, the court was basically saying, even if we can't say for sure there was a clear agreement about paying, it wouldn't be right for Judith to benefit from those improvements without giving something back to Jim and Shannon.
Exactly. You got it. And just to drive that point home, the court even quoted Justice Sanders from a different case, who said that the obligation to repay the debt or give up the value of the benefit, that focuses on the person who received the benefit, not the person who provided it.
So it doesn't matter if Jim and Shannon were acting out of pure generosity or family obligation. What matters is that Judith receives something of value, and it would be wrong for her to just keep it without paying. It shifts the focus from the intentions to the actual benefit received.
Exactly. It's a reminder that the law doesn't just protect contracts written in black and white. It also tries to protect against situations where one person benefits unfairly, even if there's no formal agreement.
So this case is like required reading for anyone dealing with property, especially if family's involved. It adds a whole other layer, doesn't it?
Oh, for sure. Family arrangement, they can be so tricky. You've got emotions, unspoken expectations. It can get messy quickly. So even though love and trust are important, when you're talking about property and money, you got to be clear. Get it in writing. Document everything.
Get it in writing. It's like a golden rule, isn't it?
Absolutely. If you want to avoid headaches later on.
Yeah.
So if we were to break down the key takeaways from Young v. Young for our listeners, what would you say those are?
First and foremost, when it comes to property improvements, especially with family, document everything.
Mm-hmm.
Spell it out. Who does what, how much, and when. Leave nothing to chance.
Yeah. Memories get fuzzy, relationships change, and then bam, you're in court because of some casual agreement from years ago. And secondly, when you're valuing those improvements, don't just focus on the costs. Think about the market value, the increase in worth, the big picture benefit.
Right. And that third point, that it's got to be unjust to keep the benefit without paying. That's where considering an unjust enrichment claim can be really important.
Right. Even if there's no contract, it can act as a safety net to ensure fairness and prevent one party from getting an unfair advantage.
So it's all about finding that balance, right? Protecting property rights, but also making sure people are compensated for their work. Now, this case does leave us with some interesting things to think about. Like, the court brought up a really good point. What happens when an improvement is only partially beneficial? Let's say, for example, that Jim and Shannon, in their quest to create this amazing otter sanctuary, they decide to install a solid gold jacuzzi for the otters.
Ooh, fancy otters. I can see it now. But I get your point. Would Judith be forced to pay for the full price of that luxurious jacuzzi, even if it only provided a tiny benefit to the otters? Would the court consider that a reasonable and necessary improvement?
That's a tough one. I'm not sure. But it definitely highlights how Young v. Young, while offering great guidance, also opens up new questions and avenues for legal exploration.
It does, and that's what makes it such a fascinating case. It really highlights the challenges in, you know, balancing individual rights and making sure that the law is applied fairly in all these different situations.
It seems like we're always trying to find that sweet spot, that balance between protecting individual rights and ensuring fairness in every case.
Exactly. On the one hand, we want to discourage people from just, you know, going around making improvements to someone else's property without a clear okay.
Yeah.
And then expecting to get paid for it. You can't just like decide to retile your neighbor's bathroom and then hand him a bill.
Right. You can't just impose your ideas, no matter how good your intentions are, on somebody else's property.
Exactly. But then on the other hand, we don't want to create a system where property owners can just take advantage of somebody else's hard work and investments, you know, without any obligation to compensate them.
It's a tough line to walk. Protecting property rights, but also making sure people aren't being taken advantage of.
It is. And this is where the restatement third of restitution comes in. Section 10 of this legal treatise really digs into these unjust enrichment principles. And it says that a person who gives a benefit to another person, not as a gift, is entitled to restitution if it would be unfair for the other party to keep that benefit without paying for it.
So it's not just about a benefit being given. It's about the intent behind the action. Was it a gift or was there an expectation of payment? And would it be, I guess, morally wrong for the recipient to keep that benefit without paying?
Exactly. And this takes us back to the burden of proof that we talked about earlier. The defendant, the person who got the benefit, it's on them to show why they shouldn't have to pay.
So they have to prove that either the person making the improvements was at fault or that the benefit they provided was pretty much worthless.
You got it. Now, another interesting thing in Young v. Young is how the court compared this case to Chandler v. Washington Toll Bridge Authority, this case from 1998 that dealt with unjust enrichment in a totally different setting.
Oh, really? What happened in Chandler? Sounds like there might be a legal precedent showdown happening here.
Well, in Chandler, the court basically said that the amount you can recover for unjust enrichment, that shouldn't be reduced by the costs the person making the claim incurred if those costs are directly related to the benefit, you know, that the defendant received. So basically, if those costs were necessary to create the benefit, you can't use them to lower the amount of compensation owed.
So even if the costs seem really high, if they were directly related to creating the benefit that the defendant is now enjoying, you can't use that to reduce what the claimant should be paid.
Right. You nailed it. And the court in Young v. Young kind of drew a parallel to this idea, really emphasizing that we should be focused on what the defendant gained, not what the plaintiff lost.
Interesting. It's not about punishing the defendant. It's about making sure they fairly compensate the plaintiff for the benefit they received.
Precisely. And this distinction is so important because unjust enrichment isn't about punishment. It's about restoring fairness, not getting revenge.
Yeah, it's not about hitting the jackpot. It's about righting a wrong.
Mm-hmm.
So for anyone out there thinking, aha, this is how I'm going to get back at my neighbor for that noisy dog, that's not quite what unjust enrichment is about.
You got it. It's about making things right, not settling scores. So as we wrap up our deep dive into Young v. Young, it's clear that this case, it's a multifaceted one. We've uncovered layers of complexity, from property law and family dynamics to the finer points of unjust enrichment and those big policy considerations that shape our legal system. It really shows how even cases that seem simple on the surface can have all these hidden depths.
It's a fantastic reminder that the law is constantly changing, evolving to meet new challenges and refine our understanding of fairness and justice. And as we conclude our deep dive, we want to leave you with one last thought to ponder. How do we make sure the law keeps up with this crazy, ever-changing world? How do we balance the need for clear rules and predictability with the flexibility to deal with new situations and achieve fair outcomes?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? And it's a question that lawyers, judges, and legal scholars will be wrestling with for a long time. We encourage you to join that conversation, to really think critically about the law and how it impacts our lives. Thanks for joining us for this deep dive, everyone. We'll see you next time.